Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Tour Guide Tell All. I am one of your hosts, Rebecca Fackner, and I am here. We're going to do a special episode this week about the Declaration of Independence because the episode's going to come out the weekend of July 4th. So we figure what better thing to talk about than the reason for the season, as it were. And so we're going to talk a little bit about some myth busting about the Declaration and the holiday. We're going to talk about some signers that are cool and don't get a lot of credit in history. And so for all of that, I decided we needed to bring in some reinforcements. The podcast is done by Free Tours by Foot, and generally the ones that you hear, Dan, Becca, Candon, and myself, we are all in Washington, D.C., but we have branches in a bunch of other places. And so we decided that for the Declaration of Independence, 4th of July, we would contact somebody where it all went down. My friend, Jen Hensel, who is the... Hi, Jen! Jen runs our tours in Philadelphia, where they talk about all kinds of fun stuff and have a really great time in Philly because it's an amazing city. But she would be a perfect person, I thought, to help me talk about the Declaration of Independence. So hi, Jen!
Hi, how are you guys doing in D.C.?
We're doing good. Summer's here. It's very warm.
I know. I've been out hiking trying to get over the cabin fever of quarantine, and I've been enjoying the little temporary pause in famous summer heat because you guys, Philly, D.C. weather, we're close enough. We're about the same.
We do it for real, man. That's true. So let's dive right in. Are you ready?
I know. We'll talk about I'm some ready because I mean, I live exactly a mile and a half due south of where all this happened. So like Independence Hall is that way, like to my right.
I love it.
Yeah. So this is, and with current events, it's even more in my mind relevant. But most people, when they think Independence Day, July 4th, fireworks, barbecues, that's when everyone signed. And oh, didn't the Liberty Bell ring and crack on that day? When I hear that, I just kind of cringe because there's so many layers that are inaccurate. And I'm saying inaccurate. So let's go.
So let's start and bust some myths. So the first myth that I want to bust because, oh my gosh, this bothers me so much. Everybody, there is nothing written on the back of the Declaration of Independence.
Actually, I have a little bit of a correction to that. There is no secret map. There is no secret message. There is nothing that Nicolas Cage would use to find a treasure.
Fair.
What is written at the very tippy top is original July 4th, 1776 copy. Now, even that is incorrect because that copy it's written on is from August 2nd. But literally, think of it. It's a file label because it would have been rolled up like a map. And if you have all your papers rolled up, you got to know like, which one is it? So literally, they just labeled it. So that when they're pulling it out of the pile, they know what it is. That's how exciting the back of the document is literally.
But there's no map.
No, there's no map. I mean, the ink that meant to be there is barely readable. It's faded so much. How do you think a map in secret ink would have survived? Like, come on. I mean, I love the movie National Treasure, don't get me wrong, but that is complete Hollywood magic.
It's completely not true. Yeah. And also, you can't steal anything from the National Archives. Like, that's ludicrous.
No.
Like, they're
no.
It's like Fort Knox. They like, literally just going in the lower building. The Declaration every night into a nuclear bomb-proof vault. Like, you're not getting it out of there. But
like, just going in the building, it is like you are going into Fort Knox of security.
That's true.
Yeah.
So the other myth, and I think this is one that's much more deeply, I feel like most people kind of realize in their right minds that there's nothing Nicolas Cage-esque on the back of the Declaration of Independence. But the other myth that's sort of harder to dispel is we celebrate on the wrong day.
Oh, this is a huge one, actually. So you kind of have to understand the timeline. And I think this is kind of, there's a couple of factors why we celebrate the wrong day. I think so many things were happening so quick that people, like especially kids when you're in school and you're being taught this, the timeline just all meshes together. So what ends up happening is June 7th, Patrick Henry Lee gives this grand speech that basically boils down to the only way we're going to get the rights that we want, we got to leave England. And that's when they realized, yeah, we got to do something. Because up to this point, more than a decade, we were trying to work with Parliament and we were getting nowhere. Yeah, that's another thing. A lot of people think we just woke up July 4th and wanted a war. But no, this is decades of politics and letters and bureaucracy and all of that.
And it's really something that how much, I feel like this gets lost, how much the colonists really thought of themselves as British.
Yeah.
And they wanted to work in the system. Yeah. Like this is, it takes a while to get to this.
Yes. And that's kind of what comes into this. So June 7th, key speeches, they decide a party of five people were put together to draft a document. I call it a press release. I think you refer to it as a breakup letter.
I really do. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the funny thing is I sometimes steal the breakup letter one because we air our grievances and say how we're going to be better without you, but it's never technically meant to have been sent to the king. There was never an issue that was supposed to be sent. Like it gets to them, but like this was for us.
Yes.
This was for us internal in the colonies to rally support. So the big guy that everyone knows, Thomas Jefferson. Now, I like to compare this when you're in school and there's a group project, there's always one guy that ends up doing all the work. John Adams almost specifically says to him and says, dude, people hate me. They like you. You write it. And Ben Franklin kind of joins in. Roger Sherman kind of, I guess, is like, okay, I'll edit your work. And then there's Robert Livingston, who's like, okay. So Tom drafts it, like literally around the corner from what is Independence Hall. And he's there for 2 weeks slaving away at this document. And he uses sources of like John Locke's Social Contract, and, you know, the Constitution by George Jefferson in Virginia and like Pennsylvania. He pulls all this stuff together and he creates this big document and he's all proud of himself. And then he has to submit it for approval. Now he gets John Adams to look at it, gets Ben Franklin to look at it. Then everyone in the party of five looks at it. They make changes. Then they submit it to the Continental Congress, which of the signers, 56 men, 24 were lawyers.
Yeah. So they're all thinking in that way, right?
Yeah, like, they're ripping through this document. And I think the grand total was 86 changes in 2 days because mm-hmm. he submits the document July 2nd because that's when we officially vote. So June 7th is when the speech took place. Then everyone kind of strategized and talked and discussed. July 2nd, and we'll come back to that because knowing the outline, that's going to come back in often. July 2nd is when we vote. So technically, that's our day of independence. July 2nd.
Yes.
That's it. That was...
And even John Adams himself writes in his like letters that he thinks that's the day that we're going to have fireworks and celebrations. And yes, they had fireworks in the 1770s. Yes. And that's the day we're going to have parades. Yes. And it's going to be great. And he... John Adams was wrong about anything.
No, what it was is our founding fathers actually tried to boycott.
Yeah.
They celebrated on the 2nd, and anyone who celebrated on the 4th, they tried to boycott.
Yeah.
But what happened is that document, they went through the changes. And so July 4th, it's finally approved. John Hancock, the president of the meeting, says, yep, we approve it. It's sent for printing July 5th, but it has that July 4th approval date. And that's what sticks because when it's first printed, it's printed on broadsides. It's in the newspaper. So that's the date that sits in everyone's minds. And then the founding fathers were like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Wrong day. Wait a minute. What are you doing? Wrong day. It should be the 2nd. That's when we made the decision. And it didn't happen right away. It kind of grew into that. It's because we started putting more importance on the document and not the event.
Yes.
Because the document became the thing, but that's not even the day we signed.
Right. No one signs on July 4th. That's the other thing. So back then, obviously, they didn't have, you know, a computer and all of that stuff. So you have to send it to a calligrapher because, you know, Thomas Jefferson's a great and smart man, but he doesn't have the super best handwriting ever. And so you send it to a professional to literally write it out in that beautiful script.
Timothy Matlack.
Right. And it takes a couple days.
Timothy Matlack, he was the assistant of the Secretary of Congress. Because if you look at the broadsides, there's two names at the bottom, not signed, because this is a newspaper. It literally just says approved by John Hancock, president of the meeting, and then the secretary, Thompson. And his assistant is Timothy Matlack. So it would be like, you know, the vice president of our country going like, yo, assistant, can you make this look nice? And Matlack had good handwriting. He had done these documents. So it wasn't like they just passed it off. But they didn't ask him to do that, I think, until like July 19th.
Yeah.
July 19th. And it takes them about 2 weeks. And then August 2nd is when they start gathering again. Now that's even more complicated, because if you look at the broadside and the August 2nd, there's a change of language, because New York didn't agree in July. It wasn't until August. So go ahead. I'm getting ahead.
Let's back up just a second. No. Yeah, that's totally fine. Let's back up just a second. So July 2nd, they vote for independence. July 4th, they basically approve the language of the document. So talk to me about the Liberty Bell.
Oh, okay.
Because everybody thinks the Liberty Bell rang at some point.
No. Like, I'm just going to put all capital letters, exclamation. The bell did not ring on July 4th. A few different reasons. And where that story comes from, I can actually tell you. One, the Liberty Bell, like, first off, it cracked on its very first ring in Philadelphia in 1752, 24 years before we're even having a declaration. That's when it cracked. It didn't crack July 4th. It cracked previous. And the bell was just to tell time and call it a government. It was just kind of a sound system of like a school. It wasn't a symbol. And also, the bell was built 2,080 pounds. It was too big for the bell tower of the State House, because it wasn't even called Independence Hall back then. That name doesn't exist till 1830s. So the bell in this bell tower is too big for the bell tower. And the
which is obvious. Yeah. Like, if you just look at the bell and look at a picture of Independence Hall, like, it just, you can tell that.
Well, that's not even the original bell tower. The one before was even smaller. Yeah. And then, like, the bell, because we were celebrating and showing off how British we were. Yeah, we ordered that bell to show off how British we were. And it was marking a Pennsylvania anniversary, which we can do a different episode on. But we order it, it cracks, we try to fix it. You know, everyone knows National Treasure, Pass and Stow. That's like one of the few things they get right.
I know, right? Yeah.
And so it's up in the bell tower, and the wooden cradle, so the wooden crossbar that hangs from, was dry rotting. So the entire bell tower and the bell were stabilized in a scaffolding. So you could not physically ring the bell at that time. And also, it would not have rung July 4th because no one signed that day. And the story that everyone knows of this little boy listening in, see them start signing, he runs up to his grandfather, the bell tower, tells him to ring on July 4th, independence, that never happened. That comes about by a gentleman, let me get his name correct because I always want to call it different, George Lippard. I want to say Captain Picard, like Star Trek. But George Lippard in 1847 writes a short story for the Saturday Courier, a short story called 4th of July. It was a fictional story for children. It was his submission for a children's book that was later published. It was completely fabricated. Yeah. Almost a century later.
Okay. So the bell, no, we're no on the bell. Absolutely not on the bell.
But to mix things up, July 8th, when they publicly read the document, all the bells of the city, like Christchurch and all the church bells, those rang. So bells did ring 4 days later.
Okay. So July 4th is kind of a non-event. No bells, no signing, whatever. July 8th is the 4 days later, is the first day they read it out publicly, right? They proclaim to the world in front of what was then the State House. It is now called Independence Hall. The founders read out this.
Actually, not the founders.
No, not the founders. Sorry. Okay.
It was a gentleman named John Nixon. Mm-hmm. Yes, related to Richard Nixon.
Cool.
And he was the town sheriff of Philadelphia. Because you have to understand, Philadelphia was the second largest English-speaking city in the world at this time, below London. So it would be like someone standing in the heart of Times Square, New York City, reading a document of treason. So they basically said, hi, you're the town sheriff. You're brave. You have all the firearms. You're going to read it. And he reads on the steps he reads it out. And that is the first time we're announcing to the world. Because even though broadsides were printed, there were people who didn't know how to read yet.
Sure. Plenty of them.
And so basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. July 8th is when we first officially announce it.
And I basically describe the Declaration of Independence as a breakup note, kind of a divorce decree, really, because they're all lawyers and that's how they thought in legal terms. But it's basically like, you know, when you break up with somebody, you write them a note and you say, look, it, these are the things you've done wrong. This is how badly you've treated me. We need to break up. It's not me. It's you. And that's essentially what it is. It's a list of grievances. The king has done these things. Parliament sucks. We need to separate from you people.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And I use that often too. It's a tiny bit, like if I'm getting nitpicky, a little bit off just because it doesn't actually intended to be delivered to the king. But that's nitpicky just for us history nerds. But yeah, it's a breakup letter. It is like, we're through. We've tried canceling. We've tried going on the couples retreat. We've tried all these things and you still ignore me. So we're done.
Yeah, exactly. How do you like me now?
Exactly. And obviously we've been rough patches, but right, we'll get through.
So then it gets, as of July 19th, they have to, this is a process that still happens in legislatures today that's a little more modern now, but it's called being engrossed and enrolled, which is basically written out sort of nicely and prettily. And then it comes back to the Continental Congress, which is still meeting. And as of August 2nd, they're still in Philadelphia. And they meet on August 2nd, and many of them, although not all, of the 56 signers are going to sign starting on August 2nd.
Yeah. Now that gets kind of interesting because a lot of people then latch on to John Hancock's signature. And a lot of people are like, oh yeah, it's so big so the king could see it. Well, okay. There's a few things in here. John Hancock always signed that big. There's letters to his sister with signatures just of the same size. Also, because he was the president of the meeting, I'm very clear in this because sometimes people latch on. He's like, he wasn't the president of the country. Our country didn't exist yet, but he was the president of the meeting because you need somebody to keep all these very strong, intelligent, opinionated people in line. And so because of his role, he would be the first person to sign in the center with then the secretary Thompson next to him. And then they kind of work their way down the 12, eventually 13 colonies. Now, they did it with the people that were there. Because some people of the original meeting, when we voted in July 2nd, 8 people were no longer involved. Some resigned. Some opted out. Some left and went to go fight. And then there was like John Dickinson, which I always crack up with that one because I live just off his street. But he chose not to sign because he really didn't think the declaration was the right way because he feared war. He was for all the ideas, but the problem was he was a Quaker, so nonviolent. And so he kind of was like, maybe one day we can be friends again. So he was still holding out. So if we're going with the whole breakup letter thing, he was like, well, maybe we'll get together one day again. And then there's Robert Livingston, who was like, okay, it's too soon. It's too early. I'm not ready for this. No. And so 50 people signed August 2nd, but we have 56 signers.
One of them, one of my favorites, Thomas McKean of Delaware.
Oh, yeah.
He holds out. The most people had signed by that following January of 1777, which is a significant date. The copy that we have, I think, is kind of finalized at that point. And Thomas McKean had not signed at that point. He actually waits. There's some people that say he waits up to 5 years to sign. And when I first read that, I was like, well, why would you wait that long? And then it occurred to me, we're in the midst of a war. Thomas McKean, no one knows, obviously, how this is going to work out. The colonists are this scrappy, ragtag bunch of dudes who are fighting the biggest empire in the world. It is not unreasonable to suspect that the colonists might fail. And so Thomas McKean's like, well, if we fail,
And to add to that, he was actually sent to the front line.
Yeah.
Literally July 3rd. So like he sent like literally the next day to go fight. So even if he was thinking of signing, he was off in the battlefield.
Right. And so he doesn't sign, I think in part because he's trying to hedge his bets. If I sign this.
That's a way to take it. I take it more that he was just trying not to die in a battlefield. True. But with history, like you can take it any way.
Yeah.
I think I'm a little bit more inclined to think favorable to him signing because of his involvement in a story we'll probably talk about a little bit later, dealing with Cesar Rodney. And so I lean a little, but like with anything, like we could both be right. You know, we're complex human beings. It's multiple emotions can be suspended at the same time. But yeah. And he actually writes in a letter arguing later on printed copy saying, hey, you left my name off. Hey. So after signing, he was kind of bitter if he got left off in printed copies. He was like, yo. So it's amusing.
It's so complicated. And the other thing that always kind of strikes me is that we have this really tight, pretty little narrative about how July 4th is the only day. And it's really just a testament to how I feel like life moves faster today. We got the Twitters and the Instagrams mm-hmm. and the internets. Life back then was a little bit slower. It took you longer to get places and do mm-hmm. things. And I feel like that's sort of part of this story is that, you know, these guys, some of them had to cool their heels in Philadelphia for the better part of a month while they could have been home doing better things. And in fact, I believe Thomas Jefferson at one point leaves to go home because he misses his wife. And they have other lives and like they're fairly, some of them, most of them are fairly important dudes. So it's really, I think, a testament to how much they believed in this, that some of them leave and then come back for August 2nd in order to sign this.
And I think that is what confuses us today when we talk about these events is that we're so used to things moving at such a fast pace that we forget these were decades in development. This was not a one-day decision. This was not a one-month movement. This was decades building up. This was months of planning, years of fighting, and then years after. And so the scale of things, and also I think oftentimes when we get it in school, we're like today it's a little different, but when I was in school, you needed it in nice little nuggets so you could fill out the little oval on your Scantron.
Yeah.
You know, your little test, like it was taught to the test, not history.
Right.
So I always tell people I hated history in school.
And you're also like rushing through it in order to get to the war, which
less. That's everyone wants to focus on the war because that's the glorious thing.
Right.
You know?
So there are 56 men and they're all men, thumbs down on that. They are all men who eventually sign it. Some of them are famous. Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Sam Adams, brewer and patriot. Two thumbs up. John Hancock, you probably have heard of. But a lot of the signers are not particularly famous outside of completely nerdy history circles, which we are in. And so we've heard of many of them. And so I don't want to talk about, I mean, Ben Franklin is fascinating all on his own.
I think there could be a whole podcast of just him.
I think it could be several podcasts.
I think there is one actually, now that I think about it.
There is. Ben Franklin's World is really great.
Yes. I couldn't remember the name.
But there, so I want to focus on some of the less well-known signers. Another signer, there's a bunch of signers that I really kind of am interested in, but the signer, my favorite signer, gotta be Button Gwinnett. I love this story. Button Gwinnett is from Georgia. He's actually born in England. He actually does not come to the colonies until 1765. So he's really only lived in the colonies in Georgia for 11 years by this time. And Button Gwinnett is relatively young. He's only 41, which is certainly not the youngest signer, but on the younger.
That's my age.
Right. But that's on the younger side of things. He's been involved in the Georgia government. He's a planter. He's not a particularly good planter, but he remains involved in the Georgia state government as the president of the Georgia sort of colonial assembly. He helps to draft their state constitution, which they still use to this day. And he's got this rivalry with this guy named Lachlan McIntosh for sort of control over colonial Georgia. Button Gwinnett is sent to be part of the Continental Congress, and Lachlan McIntosh is not, which I'm guessing sort of helped to fuel their rather intense rivalry.
They're like Georgia's Burr and Hamilton.
They really very much are Georgia's Burr and Hamilton. And so Bud and Gwinnett gets to sign the Declaration of Independence. He's one of the first to sign. If you ever, when you look at the Declaration of Independence, and you really all should because it's the 4th of July and it's important, look at the document. You'll see John Hancock's signature up top. And then furthest column on the left, the very top signature is Button Gwinnett. And he signs kind of like his name. It's as cute as a button. It's this teeny little signature.
Which is funny. I want to add, like, the idea of button today, we think is cute.
Yeah.
But like back then, buttons were really expensive.
They really were.
So it would be like someone calling their child Ruby or Sapphire or gold. Like it's cute today, but back then that would have been like, wow, you're wealthy.
Yep, he's they're showing off his wealth.
Yeah.
And so he signs the Declaration of Independence. He goes back to Georgia, and his rivalry with Lachlan McIntosh does not let up. He gains control of the Georgia Provisional Congress. He becomes the acting president of basically the commander-in-chief of Georgia's colonial military. He's president of Georgia Colony, basically. He leads their government, which puts him as the superior to his longtime rival, Lachlan McIntosh, and things do not go well, to put it mildly. There's an invasion and it fails, and Gwinnett and McIntosh blame each other and they call each other nasty names. And in fact, McIntosh publicly calls Button Gwinnett a scoundrel and a lying rascal.
They had some good insults back then. Yeah, they had some good insults.
Is hardcore.
Yeah.
And so they challenged to a duel. And this is the end result of this, is Button Gwinnett and McIntosh meet on the dueling field in May of 1777. They march their 12 paces, and they really are like Hamilton and Burr. They both shoot each other. McIntosh lives and is never charged, but Button Gwinnett dies 3 days later from a gunshot.
Yeah. And also Button's fun too, because didn't he try to organize a military support to guard the border between Georgia and Florida? Because Florida at that time
was
not
they were fighting about.
United States. That was foreign territory.
Right, it's Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they fought about. It was basically a border dispute, and they each thought the other one had bungled it. So Button Gwinnett dies on May 19, 1777. So less than a year, basically 9 months after signing the Declaration of Independence. He is the second signer to die, and he's only 42 years old, relatively obscure in his lifetime. He has been rescued in history by a very strange coincidence, and that is, there are people, for reasons passing my understanding, that want to collect documents signed by each one of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. And so they'll have, there's a collection out in San Francisco. It's anything with their signature, a grocery receipt, a diary, a love note, a church register, whatever it is, they collect the signatures of these 56 guys. So if you've got a nice collection and this is your people, different people collect different things for different reasons, and we're not going to judge, but if that's your deal, your collection is not complete unless you have Button Gwinnett's signature.
And there's like, what, 51 surviving?
There's 51 surviving copies. Most of them are going to be on official documents, and so they're not available for sale. There are only 10 copies of his signature, because he dies so young and he's relatively obscure. Only 10 copies of his signature are in private hands. And so they're super duper valuable. About a decade ago, another one was discovered. He had signed a church register in England at a wedding, and they found it in like a salt mine, and no one had known about it. And it sells for over $500,000. His signature is that sought after and valuable.
That reminds me of a guy in Philly in 1998 or 1999, buys a picture for $4 at a flea market, and the back of the picture is lined with a broadside of the Declaration of Independence. And since there's only 26 surviving copies, that guy, I think, made like $12 million.
I heard that story.
And it's so funny, the Button Gwinnett signature is so valuable that it was actually a plot for an episode, I think it was, I don't remember what year. I want to say 2014 or something, for Elementary.
Yeah, the TV show.
That was the cause for somebody committing murder, because the signature was that valuable.
Yep. It's also, he's super duper in pop culture. Isaac Asimov writes a short story called Button. And the gist of the story is somebody goes back in time and gets Button Gwinnett to sign something because his signature is going to be so valuable. And then they bring it forward in time and try to sell it. And I think the plot
Colbert and Lin-Manuel.
Yep. Colbert and Lin-Manuel write a rap about Button Gwinnett. So Button Gwinnett is the $500,000 signer. He's kind of been rescued from obscurity, but he dies in a duel.
Yeah. Cause I didn't know about him until I became a tour guide. And then I started hearing, I'm like, who's this Button? What? And then I was like,
yeah, he's super cool. He's badass. He dies in a duel. He's really cool.
Yeah. I know. He's like George's Hamilton and Burr.
He really is. He's super great.
I think that will be the next musical.
It should be. Yeah. Be a short one.
Could be. Either him or our next guy, Cesar. Oh, I love Cesar.
He's a Rodney. I love Cesar Rodney.
I have a fondness for him, and I found out about him because of a theater company in Philly called Madcap Theater, and they do historical, like, Gallagher prop style plays for school groups, and it's run by a friend of mine, Owen, and he does this amazing, and literally, the first time I saw it, I was falling over laughing so hard because I had no air intake, reenactment of his Midnight Ride, and I'm not talking Paul Revere people because he actually never does the Midnight Ride.
Cesar Rodney is really cool.
Now I do have to inject one little current event. So with the whole Black Lives Matter and re-examining who's in our public spaces, Wilmington has chosen to remove his statue because he was a slave owner. So we do have to add that because, I mean, we're talking in a very more positive light, but you do have to add that. And a lot of people are like, oh, if you remove their statues, you're going to forget their history. I didn't even know he had a statue until I saw it on the news that it was being removed. So that's not a valid argument. Talking about his whole history, I think, is a good thing. A statue is not enough in my book. But his Midnight Ride, yeah, go for it. Because I'm going to probably chime in a lot. Because this one, I I dorked out on.
Okay. So Cesar Rodney is from Delaware. And he was born in Delaware. So he, unlike Button Gwinnett, who was born in England, he's born in the colonies. And he has been called the single most valuable and productive Delawarean during the Revolutionary years.
I would put him up with one of the most productive of all of the founding fathers. And I will put forward my argument.
So that's pretty high praise.
Well, you continue the story, because if I tell you now, I'll give away the end of the story, and that will ruin the fun.
So Cesar Rodney, he was a slave owner. He has an extensive farm. He makes a good bit of money. He's very active in state government for most of his adult life. The thing about Cesar Rodney is, I think, he also suffers, so there's no authenticated portraits of him. So it's actually probably okay that the statue of him has been taken down, since we actually...
This is probably not even him.
We don't know what he looks like. And the reason that there's no portraits, he also never marries, probably for the same reason. Relatively early on in life, he develops cancer of the face. And it is not clear from the record, sort of, is it jaw cancer, nose cancer? It's not really... He apparently was very vague about this. He was very...
The records that we have is that it started on the face and then expanded to his neck.
Yeah.
And that he would often wear a gray scarf, mm-hmm. a green scarf he would often wear to cover the cancerous tumor.
Yeah, and he's very self-conscious about it.
Yeah, and it was so large that with the scarf over it, it actually would obscure his vision.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this plagues him the rest of his life. He goes through several painful surgeries. And you can imagine back then, there's not really, you know, modern medicine and anesthetic are not a thing.
Yeah.
And so they're operating on his face. And I feel like the cancer alone is enough of a reason to just stay out of politics. Like, you got enough stuff going on, but
he had asthma too.
He has really bad asthma, but he really wants to be involved. And the cancer plagues him most of his adult life. It is eventually going to kill him because they didn't really have an effective treatment mm-hmm. for cancer back then. But he's very involved in Delaware politics, which is sort of how he gets connected with the Continental Congress. You want to take it from there and talk about his dramatic movement?
Yes, this is where I get excited. And this is why I argue that Thomas McKean probably was not like hedging his bets, but maybe just got busy with trying not to die in battle. So July 1st, Thomas McKean realizes a vote is coming for the Declaration, and he's kind of, you kind of hear conversations and such, and he knows that it's going to be a tie, especially for Delaware, because each colony had one vote to approve the declaration. So all the delegates had to vote amongst themselves, and what that vote was then stood for the colony. And so Delaware had three delegates: Thomas McKean, George Read, and Cesar Rodney. Now, Cesar Rodney had gone back to Delaware, likely because of his health. He was, I mean, even with the tumor, he managed to be a sheriff in Delaware for a while. So this guy did not let a disability or hurdle stop him. So July 1st, Tom McKean panicked, knowing that this would be a tie, or sensing that, sends a messenger urgently to Delaware. Cesar gets this message. He's 80 miles from Philadelphia. 80 miles. So like by car today, that would be an hour and a half, possibly 2 hours with traffic. So even that's kind of a pain in the butt. But this is, roads are not paved. It's nighttime. It's summer. It's hot. So he gets on his horse in the middle of the night, rides 80 miles, summer heat, in dark, at midnight, and a massive thunderstorm starts. With cancer on his jaw, with asthma, and a scarf covering it that he's likely only able to see out of one eye. So with all of these obstacles, he gets to Philadelphia literally July 2nd in the morning. And the story goes that he literally walked in, like the first three colonies, I think it was New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Connecticut had voted. He walks in his boots and spurs. So I have this vision of him literally like a Western flying off his saddle into the door.
Like mud splattered and
yes,
gross.
Mud splattered, soaked, tired, sweaty. They were probably like, who is this maniac? And he walks in.
And you can imagine that the scarf probably yes. didn't stay right because he's riding fast.
And he walks in. He goes to Thomas McKean and votes immediately for the declaration. Now this, okay, that's great for Delaware, but it's also pivotal, and this is where my argument comes in, because the southern states, the Carolinas, North and South, and Georgia, they were not really big fans of the declaration. They were very reluctant, especially since the early draft included a lot of blaming the British Empire for the slave trade in the colonies. Thomas Jefferson had put that. But the southern states at that time, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, those three objected. And so it was pulled out. Ben Franklin really was upset about this personally. But it was either that or you have three colonies that choose to side with the British. So they pull it out thinking, as Ben Franklin said, first things first. Now, they were very on the fence. They were kind of not sure. They also had the youngest delegate. Edward Rutledge was 26 compared to Ben Franklin, 70. So, like, they kind of sent the interns, as I kind of always imagined it.
They did. I always think that because they didn't think it was that important. Like, no. South Carolina was like, oh, I don't know if this is going to be a real thing, so we'll just send four guys that don't really matter.
Yeah. So, like, they're unsure, they're nervous, they're whatever. And then seeing this dramatic moment of this guy against all odds, riding through the night, that takes this so seriously. And Delaware is sort of on the cusp there, you know, it's kind of a border region. So it's a little bit southern, it's a little bit north. And that turns the tide. And the southern states are like, okay, I guess we'll vote too. And so it kind of not only turned Delaware, it turned the South.
Yeah.
And they supported it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's...
If you see a guy willing to do that, you're like, well, maybe he's got the right idea.
Exactly. Like, that's kind of one of the things I think about. Like, he does this through all of these odds. Like, this means that much to him. It's yeah. that big of a deal for him. And his reward by his constituents in Delaware is to almost immediately defeat him as a delegate to the Delaware Colonial Assembly. Like, he's almost immediately defeated. And he... A couple years later, in 1778, he gets elected president of Delaware. This really is going to sap his strength. And he dies in 1783, right before they sort of sign the peace treaty with the British.
Yeah. So like he goes through this whole arduous thing and never really sees it come to fruition. And it's like, if anyone, like I always kind of like, I'm very pro voting. And so I've had a couple of times where like lesser local elections, nothing big, but local ones are like a primary. They're like, oh, do I really want to go? It's going to be raining. And I'm Caesar. Hey. And so I use him as my argument why every human has to vote. There's no excuse.
Yeah, exactly. If he could show up with cancer through a midnight thunderstorm ride.
80 miles on horseback.
Oh my God. The poor horse too.
The poor horse and his backside must have been killing him.
Oh my God, yeah.
That. He must have walked in like all wide, like a Western. Oh yeah. And I
love it.
Like I visualize it and that's the real midnight ride. Paul Revere's Midnight Ride Longfellow. It's a pretty poem. Never happened.
Either
it happened. Like that's the midnight ride.
And how is that not more famous? Right? Like how is he not more famous?
Because his name doesn't have the ring. It doesn't have the panache. Yeah. You know, and like you don't want your leading man, I guess, covered up with Phantom of the Opera. They cover up his face with that one, so
they do.
But you can make Green Scarf very dashing. Like imagine it flapping in the wind. I don't know, but yeah, he should be famous. He should be the next Lin-Manuel. If you hear us, he's next.
Yes, he's next. He really needs. So the other thing I've talked about two of my favorite signers of the Declaration of Independence, and there are a lot of
Caesar is one of mine, so we kind of got an overlap there. My other favorite, nowhere near as dramatic, so it's kind of like, no, for something completely different, is Francis Hopkinson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's my favorite because he's a Philly born and bred. He's not well known. And all the achievement, like the achievement probably biggest that he's known for, somebody else gets credit for it. So Francis Hopkinson, he's born and bred in Philadelphia. He trains to be a lawyer. He's actually one of the early graduating classes out of what is now a University of Pennsylvania. But I like to joke, being a lawyer was more of his day job. He really was a musician and a designer. So that would be his side hustles. He was an avid harpsichordist. He was not a professional, but he started learning it at 17 and showed great potential. He wrote the first American official opera. He wrote numerous songs. He became the organist at Christ Church. And while at Christ Church, he also taught free and enslaved Black and African Americans to read. They gave him a room in the church and he taught them how to read. He really thought education should be available to all. And that was a very common concept, actually, in Philadelphia. He designed the seal for one of the schools of the University of Pennsylvania, the seal of New Jersey, many government official seals. He was part of the design committee for the U.S. National Seal, our eagle. He was part of that design. He was the Secretary of the Navy. But the thing that he did that most people acknowledge, but not to him, is our American flag.
We just did an episode about this.
I know. I didn't see that. I saw it. I didn't listen to it yet because I'm very backlogged on my podcast, I'll be honest. And so Betsy Ross, there's a huge debate whether or not she even made the flag.
Listen to our pod on it. We go all into this. Yeah.
There's no proof.
None.
There's no proof.
Yeah.
Or there is, but there's also no disproof. So as a Philadelphian, I'm just like, maybe. Like I kind of go in the middle. Because when you say she didn't make it, people kind of bash her. This was not her. She is a woman, was a great woman. She was a great seamstress. She made other flags.
That's what I talk about in the pod. Like I say, we should reclaim Betsy Ross as a feminist icon because she survived the war and raised her kids and did cool stuff.
Yeah. She packaged practically 250,000 cartridges of ammunition, bundled. She was a little rebel, but honestly, she may have made it. Who knows? I'm kind of like still kind of like maybe, but we do have proof of who designed it. Francis Hopkinson did. He writes because he has two seals and designs that he had already done, that he took components of those drafts, put together into our American flag. The white star in a field of blue, inspired by George Washington's family seal, the 13 stripes he pulls from another design that he has done already, the specific 7 red, 6 white, that is literally copied. He outlines why colors, he has letters. We don't have his original drawings, but we have his letters, journal entries. We have journal entries of other people who kind of reviewed it. He was on the board and committee to approve a design. And the best part is Betsy Ross gets all the credit and he doesn't even get paid for it. So after the war, he goes and sends a letter. He's like, hi, you're using my design. Can I be paid? All he wants, and this is part of, I think, why I love him so much. All he wants is a quarter cask of wine.
Man, after my own heart.
It would be like an artist saying, yo, pay me in a keg. He just wants to have wine, and he designs the flag and he gets no credit.
I can also be paid in wine. That's also, yeah.
Oh, me
right
too.
Here.
But like, that's why I think he's my favorite, because like, it's that underdog. Also,
very Philly.
He was in Philadelphia, but he moved to New Jersey. So it's just this whole, yeah. So he's my favorite.
I love it.
Whenever I go to Christchurch, I always sit in his pew. He stayed good friends with Ben and George, wrote letters. I think he was sort of almost like an adopted son to Ben Franklin, because his son William divided. So Francis Hopkinson sort of, like, their friendship sort of filled that gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to me, the sort of relationships between the signers too. There's a bunch of those, particularly from the southern states, that are actually like, have a bunch of family ties. They're all kind of related to each other.
And then talking about all the Adams, like,
yeah, several Adamses. There's the Lee family, Francis Lightfoot Lee and Richard Henry Lee, who are.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm kind of related to.
Cool.
Because I have Lees in my family. So I'm related to Robert E. Lee. Through him, I'm related to Richard Henry Lee, which I also went to an elementary school called Thomas Paine, and my college was Washington and Jefferson. So I always joke, like, if I'm not meant to be a tour guide, come on.
I drink a lot of Sam Adams beer, so that's obviously
I go Yingling.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
There's that my mom went to Lyman Hall High School. He's this, another of the signers from Georgia. So yeah, there's a lot of the signers are kind of everywhere. Once you learn to look for them, they're kind of all over the place.
And this event isn't some static thing. Like in Philadelphia, I can't speak for everyone, but in Philadelphia, we really call this an experiment. We call the nation an experiment. And you turn on the news and you're seeing on the news literally stuff that ties directly to what this document is, what this laid the groundwork for, what this happened. Like, this was, as Ben, not Ben Franklin, I have Ben on the brain. But Martin Luther King said, this was a promissory note. All men created equal, all mankind. Yeah, it was a bunch of rich white guys, but they laid groundwork for all of us to be included. You mentioned John Adams writing to Abigail. I love Abigail, how she then responds, like, great, you got half the population. What about the rest of us? She did not pull punches.
She didn't play. So, I like that about her. Yeah, so the Declaration of Independence happens, and the immediate impact of it is we were already kind of at war. Like, there had already been battles. One of the people always, particularly in D.C., well, obviously, George Washington signed the Declaration of Independence. No. George Washington did not.
He was in New York.
He was fighting the war.
He was
war.
In New York, like, fighting.
He didn't do that great fighting in New York, it must be said. That one didn't go so great for him. But he also so George Washington's going to make his reputation and be famous, partly because of sort of the exploits at this time. But immediately after this, the colonies decide, we're going to really do this. We got to really do this. And so the Declaration kind of spurs them to create a government, such as it was during the war.
And it lays a lot of groundwork. Like, if you read through the whole Declaration, which I don't think many people actually do, but if you read through the whole thing, you can see that there are echoes of what later goes into our Constitution, that later, and also like what inspires our Declaration. Like, as I mentioned, John Locke's social contract of how government should treat its people. Then you have the Constitution of Virginia by George Mason, which that had influence. Pennsylvania's charter, religious freedom, those were all influence on the Declaration that then influenced the Constitution. the Declaration was also, as I mentioned before, it wasn't meant to be to the king. It was meant to us in the colonies. Because, yeah, we were fighting. You know, you had Lexington and Concord. The shot heard around the world. You had skirmishes. You had fights. You had all this unrest. And the colonies were not 100% behind this. We were very divided. A founding father that I kind of get a kick out of, Richard Stockton, who he didn't technically recant the Declaration, but he's often seen as recanting. He was captured not by British forces, but by Tories, people loyal. So these were actual colonists that went into his house, pulled him out of bed. He was in his pajamas and he's dragged off to jail to New York. And it wasn't the British troops. It was other colonists. Even among the founding fathers, they strongly disagreed. And I think everyone gets this perception like that everyone was behind this. No.
No. And there's a lot of scholarship that says that this was a rich white person movement, that there were a lot of sort of lower classes that may or may not have been in favor, and that we assume that they went along with it because they did some of the fighting, but did they really? Like, there's a lot of debate about how uniform this support was.
And then there's also groups that were for it, but in a different capacity. Like I mentioned, John Dickinson being a Quaker, the Quakers, or their name, Religious Society of Friends, they were nonviolent. They believed in the cause of the revolution, but they didn't believe in the necessity of violence and war. And because they refused to fight, and that's where Betsy Ross, she kind of broke away from the majority of the religion because she was willing to defend. But Quakers got a lot of heat because people thought they were pro-British. They were just against the violence. And a lot of people, I think, were that way too, where they were like either against the violence or they were like, I'm barely surviving. Or they were somebody else's possessions that didn't even have a say or were asking, who am I going to have a better future with? Because if you were a slave, you had to really look at that. You know, look at what side, like who would treat me better?
Yeah, exactly. That's true. It's not uniform at all. So yeah, it's this really interesting moment that we think is of being like a monolith and sort of very, you know, and it really was not at all.
No, how our government, we can't agree on anything now. We were just as bad, even more so, because when we were getting the Constitution, we had a fencing match breakout with a walking cane and fireplace tongs. They were literally fighting, fist fights on the on the Congress floor. And I don't remember who, a colleague of mine told me this story, a delegate from South Carolina originally didn't want to sign the Declaration of Independence because we Northerners wore wool socks.
Makes sense. I never liked the wool socks either.
Yeah. Well, up in Philadelphia, come February, you need the wool socks.
Yeah.
But it was just showing like they were just trying to find a reason to not agree. They were looking for anything.
Sure. So yeah. We celebrate on the wrong day.
Yeah. I think we should celebrate July 2nd to August 2nd.
I think it should be a whole month. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
It should be a whole month every year. I like it. We should all get it off too. Oh, wait.
Oh. Well, everybody else should get vacation and we should get more work because I don't know about in DC. But July 4th, that time of year, is very busy for us.
You know,
that is our busiest time of year.
Which actually sort of segues into the next thing I want to mention. So one of the things that we do with this pod, at the end of the pod, we talk about where you can see whatever we're talking about in DC. So in Washington, obviously, you can see the actual Declaration of Independence. I mean, not at this moment because it's not open because we're in the middle of a pandemic. But when that's over, you can go to the National Archives. You can stand in line. You got to go through security. And you can actually stand and look out into the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And when you check it out, the Declaration of Independence today is very, very faded. It's under low light because they're trying to preserve the Declaration as long as possible. It's hard to make out what it actually says because, again, it's so faded. But they around the corner from the Great Rotunda, they actually have a copy of it on the wall so you can see sort of what it says. But that's the big Declaration of Independence spot in Washington.
Well, that's the August 2nd engrossed one. So in Philadelphia, we got more bang for your buck. First off, the security is not quite as intense. You still have to go through security. But if you go into what is known as Independence Square, which is the building surrounding Independence Hall. So Independence Hall, you can actually go when it's open again, after the pandemic, national park, you get your ticket, you go through security, and you're guided through, and you actually stand in the room. You stand in the room. So not just the document, like you're standing in the room where the vote, where the debates, where the arguments took place, where the declaration was, where the Articles of Federation were later signed and approved, where the Constitution was created and signed. Literally, that's our definition of the room where it all happened.
And it is the same room. Like it's not three different rooms.
It's all the same room. And like literally you don't even have to move.
And it's not as big as you think it's going to be. It's always strikes me that how much smaller it is than it would be in your head.
Well, the kicker with that is part of why they chose that building. And this is the one that makes everyone's eyes bug, is that was the largest public building in the colonies at the time. Like, I love that. I love that fact because it just, we're so tiny. I heard a park ranger, I'm getting off topic, but I'll come back. But I heard a park ranger once while I was on a tour inside that very room, make a comparison of the colonies fighting against the British Empire. Because today the United States, we're sea to shining sea. But back then we were these 13 kind of disorganized ragtag little colonies. So he compared it to be like the Bahama Islands trying to wage a war against Russia.
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah. And that stuck with me because landmass, population, military power, it all lines up. So yeah. So we won. The little guy won. Not alone, but we won. But back to what I was saying. So you have a tour of that. Then inside that same security zone, you don't need a ticket. You go to a little building called the West Wing. Haha. Inside there, there's an exhibit called the Great Essentials. And that is where we have one of the original printed broadsides. And we often have George Washington's personal copy. Now we have a couple of copies. I think we have like two that they'll rotate so they don't fade, but that's the original broadside. Now, if you see George Washington's, and I want to double check that. I tried to hunt down, but I think they're kind of cagey with that because they don't want people to try and do a Nicolas Cage and steal it. But that's the one that John Hancock actually delivered to George in New York. And he read at City Hall of New York City on July 9th because he was so excited about this because he wasn't there for the Declaration. If you see a painting with George in it, it's the Constitution. Like they look identical. It just, where's George? Oh, yeah. And so you see the original printed broadsides. You also see the silver inkwell that was used to sign all those documents. And then you also see a copy of, I think, the Articles of Federation as well as the Bill of Rights. And remember, the broadsides were first. Those are July 5th. Because what happens is a lot of times now we think handwritten because we tend to handwrite and then type on our computers. The handwritten came second. So you can get that in Philly. And then you can walk around, go to City Tavern, where a lot of the debates about the Declaration and the drafting, you can sit there and get a pint. Go to the Declaration House around the corner. You can stand in front of the building where Thomas Jefferson lived while he was drafting it. You can then go two blocks and go to Franklin Court, where Ben Franklin lived while he was drafting it.
Yep.
You can do all of that in a span of five blocks.
Love that about Old City, Philadelphia. It's very compact. Yeah. All right there. You can even see the Liberty Bell, yeah, which absolutely did not ring on July 4th.
Nope.
Absolutely not.
Nope. Sorry.
Also, a little tip for people visiting Philadelphia. If you want to see the Liberty Bell and there's a huge line, don't stand in the line. Just go to the front.
There's a window. You can cheat. And also, like, Philly is more than just this neighborhood.
Yes.
It's huge. I crack up because I get at least, when tours are running, I get at least once a month, someone argue with me that DC is bigger than Philly.
No. No. If you take like the outer DC, all the suburbs, maybe, but that's not DC proper. Then
the same with us, because if we do the outer suburbs, because we're in the center of the megapolis, we've got New Jersey. We've got, yeah.
No.
I know. It cracks me up. But they only see Independence Mall. And so that's their perception. Yeah.
So any other Declaration of Independence fun facts or myths of us, anything else before we...
I know, I'm trying to think because I definitely went with the verbal blah, 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 because I'm talking to another human. It's so exciting these days. But the Declaration, I mean, it traveled around.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize how much it traveled around.
And it wasn't particularly well taken care of at first. Like they just shoved it in a backpack.
As I said, it was rolled up. Yeah. It was rolled up. It was taken around with the Continental Army. It then traveled around after it was in DC, it was in Philly, it moved around because it wasn't until I think more modern times, and I don't know exactly when the shift occurred, that the document became more important than the event. Because early on to them, it was just a piece of paper. To us now, that's the thing. And they forget the event. They forget the people. And I don't know when the shift occurred.
It isn't clear to me either, but at some point it really did in a big way because it's really unfortunate that we focus on the, I mean, the document's fine, it's great, but it's really the event that's particularly important.
Yeah, the event that literally changed world history because the Declaration set off a series of events that creates our Constitution, that creates our nation, that every nation in the world with a democratic system with a constitution in the world is inspired
by. Right.
Many other revolutions were sparked and inspired by the Declaration.
Right. The Haitian Revolution just a couple years later in our own continent.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Like so many of these events.
Yeah. It's true.
And all it tends to get is July 4th, this date.
Yes.
And I heard, I was at a lecture once and somebody was comparing American and British views of history. And they were talking about the July 4th comparison and King Arthur comparison and how they try to find history in the myth.
Yes. And we try to mythologize our history. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And that always resonated with me. And I think that does an injustice because when you make it a myth, you only focus on the glory, the beauty, the perfection, when really, like to me, like
it's about the mess.
It's a hot mess. It's real people like Cesar Rodney being a slave owner, having negative qualities of who he is. Also good things. I like seeing the whole fuller picture of an individual because then I realize like, hey, these are real people that made this earth shattering decision. So like when I look at the news and I'm seeing people in the protest lines or I'm seeing people on Congress floor, I'm like, wait a minute, those have the same power. They have the same capabilities. These weren't special demigods. They were just regular people that put their stockings on one at a time.
The wool socks. Let's not forget the wool socks.
The wool socks or the silk stockings or cotton. Yeah.
Well, this has been so much fun.
Sorry, I probably have ran away so hijacked.
No worries. It's totally fine.
You understand, I talk about this every day. I go by Independence Hall almost daily. I have to pass it to go to like one of my banks. I have to pass it to go to my pharmacy. I shortcut through Franklin Court to go to the post office. This is not...
His post office.
Yeah, his post office. It's not like this is frozen. And I think in a lot of places, it's history is a very frozen, set in stone thing. Whereas here in Philadelphia, it's still a living thing. And it gives us, or at least me, a different perspective. And I ask myself frequently, what would be their reaction to today's events? Like what's going on today and how would they side?
Mm-hmm. It's an unknowable question, but it's a really good one to figure out sort of where would they be. Yeah. Well, this has been really fun. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the pod about this. This has been really cool. I love talking about the Declaration of Independence. And when this is all over, definitely check out Philly. There's so much more to Philly than just the Declaration and Independence Hall, but it is very cool and worth checking out.
Yes, our neighbors, the other Capitol, since you know we were the Capitol before you guys.
Yes. And then you come to DC and you can actually see the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution all in.
Yep. You can see both and compare the language. That would be
it's
fun.
It's really cool. So thanks everybody for tuning in. It's been another great episode. We appreciate y'all so much for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. Send us some feedback. And thanks so much to Jen for being our guest star and for taking us through this. Hope you've enjoyed it. And see you guys next time.
See you guys. Be safe.
This has been a special holiday edition of Tour Guide Tell All, exploring myths around the Declaration of Independence. Join us Monday for our regularly scheduled episode as we continue this topic and explore the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Just a reminder that both DC by foot and Philadelphia by foot are starting to open up, as well as many of our free tours by foot cities. And if you're interested in a small private tour, please contact us or check out our webpage at freetoursbyfoot.com.